All systems nominal. Gate has responded to IFF code. IFF read and accepted. Data transfer complete.
Welcome, fellow mech warriors and freeborns. I'm Adam.
I'm Dan.
And this is a long belated episode of The Memory Core. Dan, how you been?
Very, very tired, very worn out, but I still, you know, have been doing some projects lately. I took a break from Battletech, but I made a dice tower. That was kind of fun.
Cool.
Looks like a kid made it, but it's starting out like that anyway, because my daughter's the one who's, like, way better at freehanding, like, paint stuff and all of that. I could probably put up a picture of it.
This is like that that well-known photo of the space marine with, like, the face painted, but it's just...
Not that bad.
Layers and layers.
No, not that bad.
It's, like, straight from the pot, just slapped on.
My mistake was I used, like, plywood from Hobby Lobby, like, that thin stuff.
Yeah.
So anything I did, like, it would, like, split a little bit or something.
Yeah, it's probably...
It was a bad idea.
Yeah, plywood's kind of tough to work with when it's that thin, although in theory it's stable because of the way plywood works. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I know what you mean, and it's tough too because if you don't have the right tools, getting clean cuts on it probably isn't that great either.
No, it's not. But, you know, it was fun. It was a new thing to do. I haven't really made anything like that in a long time, so it was refreshing.
Cool.
You got to do something to keep your interest and things and your blood flowing, you know?
Yeah. I don't know if, you know, for those of you who follow us and have checked on our community tab, but around Labor Day weekend, I was in Denton, Texas for ReaperCon. And so a lot of July and August was kind of gearing up for that, you know, picking a miniature, absolutely fucking it up. I mean, like, starting over on something else. Making things excessively difficult. But it was my first time at a gaming convention. You know, I've always dreamed of, like, going to Gen Con. And then as I became an adult, I was like, oh, yeah.
I could do these things now.
Yeah, I could do these things now. But I don't want to go to that one because people smell. I've heard that Gen Con's gotten a lot better than it used to be back in the day. But ReaperCon was actually a really, really cool scene. I took a lot of really cool courses, met a lot of really cool people, and a lot of really, really excellent painters. And there were some other Battletech entries for the competition. Ross Hines, or Savage Coyote, was there. I met him briefly. I was running between courses. He was running a Cav game, which is Reaper's mecha game. And I just quickly, like, interrupted him, said hi. He's very, very Texan, but he's a really, really nice dude. He actually took home a gold for his entry. It was a Cav miniature. I didn't actually get to see it in person. It must have got there on the display from between when I was in there. Maybe it was, like, a Saturday entry, and I didn't get to see it.
It might actually be up in the Battletech group anyway, because they a lot of times they use Cav miniatures for proxies.
Yeah, but, I mean, Ross is a really nice guy. He's also, you know, quite a good painter himself. And it was really cool. I entered two miniatures. I did a dark sword piece of the bard playing the violin. And I did my Ost Scout, which was not only, like, the oldest sculpt, but I'm pretty sure the oldest miniature there, full stop. I mean, it was a lead one, too. So it was great. And I got really good feedback. I ended up getting silvers for both, which is what I hope to get. When I sat down and got feedback from the judges, what felt really good was I'm really close to getting golds. And there's just a few things I need to tweak, some things I maybe need to try to increase visual interest. Jeffrey Davis from Hecatina Miniatures, who also posts at the Battletech Painting and Customs, was actually one of the judges and one of my teachers for one of the courses I took, and provided some really great feedback on some ideas on how to properly represent the scale of the miniatures. And so those are things I've been thinking about and I want to try and incorporate. But in general, it was a really positive experience. And, you know, one of the judges was like, yeah, you had the best white there, which was fantastic because white's a really hard color. But you know, I did really, really, really well on a lot of things that I worked very hard on, and the things I need to fix are easy to fix, and it feels as though a gold is really attainable, which is fantastic. You know, one of the things you'll see on a lot of groups is just there's a lot of positivity, you know, short of using like the old miniatures where everyone's like, ugh, you mean this one stinks. It's like, ah, fuck off.
Yeah, you get really tired of that real fast.
But in general, there's a lot of positivity either the Battletech official fora or the Facebook groups when it comes to the people who post their miniatures and post their work. But there's not a lot of critical feedback. And to actually get constructive criticism and for, you know, to have been judged by three different people and for them all to have given me the same feedback was really powerful because it wasn't just, well, you know, I disagree with the other guy and, you know, I would have done it this way or I like what you did here but not here. They all said the same thing. And so that gives me a really clear point of direction on how to improve.
Yeah. The actual people who have honed their crafts over the years, coming together to tell you, like, hey, you're doing good. You could probably be one of us in the future.
Yeah, yeah.
Essentially.
And, you know, a ReaperCon, the reason why I went to ReaperCon instead of going to, like, Adepticon, which is just in Schaumburg, which maybe we'll have to do next year, Dan.
I'd like to.
Or going to Gen Con is, I mean, Reaper, it's a small convention that's focused mainly on painting versus gaming, which is where like I'm interested in going in the hobby. It's a very, very good crowd. But what really it is, I really like Reaper paints. And I know you know that, Dan. You've seen my collection. Yeah, their metallics aren't great. But I've tried other paints. And I actually tried a lot of other paints while I was there. Because people, they're just hanging out. Like one guy had Pro Acryl. You know, one guy had Vallejo. Of course, we've all messed with GW stuff. Army Painter stuff. Every time I try something else, I keep thinking, I like using Reaper. I miss using Reaper. And whether or not Reaper has the pigment density, and I think the pigment density is fine. You know, whether or not they do a lot of single pigment stuff, and they do some single pigment things.
Mm-hmm.
They have a large variety. The Triad system is really easy to start to use. It's just the way that it flows off the paintbrush, the way it dilutes, the way it glazes, the way it layers, the way it comes out of the pot, and just really just the way it feels when it leaves the brush.
Now, their paints are probably one of the most popular ones out there, right?
Well, I don't know. Well, God, yes and no. So, and had I known it was her, I would have, you know, talked to her. I would have kind of cornered her and be like, I want to ask you so many questions about paint. Mm-hmm. But Anne Forrester, who is an award-winning painter herself, and she's still very active with Reaper, she was the one who originally developed the line.
Yeah.
And, you know, here's someone who's an award-winning painter developing a paint line and doing what she wants the paint line to do, which is really cool, versus some of the other stuff. It just doesn't feel the same with other companies. Like, this was formulated for a very specific purpose, whereas, you know, Vallejo model colors, like, if you want to get, you know, good paints that do a lot of really cool things and grow with you, but, you know, we're really focused on colors. You know, GW, for all its faults, is like, how can we maximize our profits? But, you know, a lot of their paints are pretty pigment dense, although they're a little bit on the more satiny side, and the Reaper paints are very flat. They're very matte. So the idea is that, you know, if you were painting a competition piece, you could choose your finish with additives and then not varnish the whole thing, you know, because you don't have to flatten everything out. But I think, you know, no matter what, when it comes down to it, when I've tried other paints, it's always, wow, I like the way Reaper feels off the brush, which I haven't been able to find elsewhere.
Do you think... the reason that you keep going back to Reaper is because it's more like, I mean, obviously more like a personal preference, or do you think it's because like you're reaching that next level and you're like, you feel like these paints are more professional, I guess, if that makes sense. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they're definitely beginner friendly too, but it definitely also feels as though they kind of are professional. You know, you're not worried about necessarily how much pigment is crammed into that bottle. You're just worried, you know, does it do what I want it to do?
Yeah, because we talk about Army Painter, and obviously we talk about a lot of painting here, and it's interesting to see you evolve, like, beyond, like, Army Painter and that. But it's also cool because as we either complain or whatever about, like, these other brands, to see, like, different perspectives from people and, like, what they prefer. Which is why I'm picking your brain a little bit.
Well, and, you know, we started picking up some of those bottles of the Golden Fluid Acrylics from Michael's recently. Yeah. And it lists the pigments. We know what's a single pigment, what's a blend, what that means. You know, going zinc white versus titanium white, what does that mean for your painting? And one of the miniatures I painted at the Bard, I did that totally in the Golden Fluid Acrylics.
Mm-hmm.
They're really powerful, but what's weird is that because I think, is it a gouache medium? Whatever the medium is, it is super hydrophilic. And so if it's on your wet palette for too long, unless that wet palette is relatively dry, it just sucks up the moisture through the paper.
That's what happened when we were playing with the inks too.
Yeah,
that I got.
And so it becomes really hard to control. So you're constantly refreshing the palette. They're very durable, but they're also gloss, because Golden's idea was that, you know, here's the pigment, and if the pigment is kind of naturally satin or matte, that's what you're getting. And if it's mm-hmm. naturally glossy, that's what you're getting. And so one of the things I noticed was that their yellow ochre is a bit flatter than, say, their pyrrole red. Or their ivory black. And there are definitely pros and cons to that. Golden's titanium white avoids the chalky nature that you get with a lot of other whites, because titanium white's just a really large pigment on its own.
There was one I picked up, right?
I think so.
We played with a bit? Yeah. Because I kind of noticed that too.
Yeah.
But it was either that or you showed me.
Yeah. But, you know, even having like an ivory black, you know, ivory black is a transparent black that you can use for glazing and mixing better than you can a really opaque lamp black. And that gets into really heady stuff. And we're getting way off track, because I know, like, we'll never get to the next topic if I keep chatting about paint. But
yeah.
You know, regardless, you know, it was really great to go. It was really great to get feedback. It was really great to meet new people, to talk to people. I met Julie Guthrie, whom I'm hoping to have a longer conversation with next year. You know, Julie Guthrie got her start with Ralph Partha. She did mostly fantasy stuff, but she also sculpted a couple of the TRO 2750, a couple of the 3025 Max, and a couple of the aerospace fighters. So, like, the Hermes 2, the Quick Draw, you know, the ones that I painted by her recently. And had I known and remembered to put it together, I would have, like, here's a photo of what I painted. You sculpted this, like, 30 fucking years ago. I love it. She had some cool things about the difference in what it was like to make those BattleTech miniatures, especially out of greens, right? What goes into making it. And it sounded almost as though you make your skeleton or your armature out of wire, you make rough shapes of the green stuff, and then you do like a skim coat of green stuff over that to get it really precise and accurate. It was really cool. And I guess, and actually, side note, this is the second time we record this podcast, because the first time we did it, I was like, that kind of sucks. And Dan was like, yeah, it really fucking sucked. actually, Tom Meyer for Ralph Partha Legacy is doing a big Q&A, so we can submit him questions by email. And I don't know if he's going to be really interested in answering anything about BattleTech stuff, because he didn't really like sculpting those mechanical miniatures. But
hey, maybe we can...
maybe we can just, you know, Pick his brain a little bit. And other questions.
Ask him what he liked about doing the BattleTech miniatures and what he hated, you know?
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
Even finding out stuff like that, it would benefit a lot of sculptors too, you know?
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, Reaper was great. And I am looking forward to going back next year. And I've already am stressing myself out about what I'm going to paint next year.
Well, you got a whole year.
I got a whole year. But yeah, so that's what's been up with us. You know, Dan's been had his stuff doing projects. You know, I was at ReaperCon. Work, of course, is always crazy. But that's enough of this. Dan?
Yes.
Tell us, Why are we here?
Why are we here? You woke me up. You dragged me out of my house. My back is hurting. We're here to talk about a book that, believe it or not, I actually do like it. I grew up, it was one of the first BattleTech books that I read in, what was it? I think in high school, I was probably, well.
Yeah, we would have been in high school.
Man. Yeah, it was a while ago. But yeah, Roar of Honor by Blaine Lee Pardo. We wanted to revisit this one, obviously because of Hour at a Wolf. And Blaine's, you know, he published a lot of stuff fairly recently, a lot of stories, and we're kind of taking the opportunity. So for me, this is a revisit. So I pretty much have a perspective from what I can remember when I first read it when I was young, and seeing what I get to see what I got from it from then and what I get from it from now being older. You know, and reading a lot more, probably not that much more, but reading a lot more. Yeah. And
well, it's always more. Tricky looking at something that you loved as a kid and then going back and reading it as an adult and like, okay, did that hold up? Sometimes it feels really cringe. You know, I'm you know, what do you do when you grow up? You mm-hmm. can't help it. But of course, Pardo's been really important for BattleTech since almost the very beginning.
Oh, yeah. Snords of Regulars to TRO 3025 entries.
You know,
He's been a part of this.
3025 might have been...
this machine forever.
3025 might have been the first stuff he wrote for... maybe...
he might have mentioned that.
You know,
I vaguely remember him mentioning that was... it might not have been TRO 3025, yeah. But he did come in, I think, around that time.
Yeah. And I think he did... I know he contributed stuff to the Clan Wolf source book, maybe the Jade Falcon source book, although those came out pretty close to the same time, so maybe they split those tasks up. I think his first source book that he ever wrote almost solo was the Comstar one.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you know, he's written a bunch of novels. But, you know, things have changed.
Yeah. So the other idea is... and I don't really want to speak for you here. I don't know what experience you were trying to get out of it, but I feel like it's a fair way, because eventually, we're going to get to Hour of a Wolf. We're going to reread it. You know, we're going to give it a fair shot. The same way we gave Roar of Honor a fair shot here, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I genuinely did like this book when I first read it.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, you know, Pardo's history... you can't divorce it completely from BattleTech. You know, he certainly has his bad habits, and he's got things that are they're good that he does. I want to avoid, for now at least, a lot of the... and I know you agree with me too, Dan, on that.
Yeah.
But a lot of the more recent political upheavals and the various nebulous things and just the wailing and gnashing of teeth of what's happened in the past couple of years... but, you know, here we are, you know, we're in our late 30s. We are hopefully, you know, critical readers, and, you know, no one should be completely free of criticism. And I know there's a lot of people that really love Pardo's writing. I don't, although I had a higher opinion of him when I was younger, having read a lot of his Archer Cristofori stuff, which I think that was my big introduction, because I started reading those novels right with the FedCom Civil War. And that seemed to be the most natural jumping on point. And then kind of worked my way forward and then backwards from there. But yeah, I mean, Pardo's got stuff that he does great. And there's some stuff that he does eh. And there's some stuff that's like, dude, you need to stop that. It's like really bad habits. And we see this. And a lot of what we're going to see in Roar of Honor here feels repeated elsewhere, particularly in Hour of the Wolf.
Mm-hmm.
Both in...
presentation.
Presentation, theming.
Yeah.
Actual events that happen.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not going to get into spoilers just yet. Dan, I got a couple of notes written down. I know what you've got from like before we get into spoilers.
Yeah. Okay, so this is where I'm going to add the spoiler tag, because I want to at least give everybody a gist of what the...
do you want to do spoilers right now, or do you want me to go through my stuff that's free of spoilers?
Yeah, most of my stuff is spoiler.
So, okay.
So, yeah, we'll start with you.
So, yeah. What things that I notice, especially with Pardo's writing, is that he does rely on relatively simple tropes. And a lot of this comes down to, I don't know how much of this is the medium. And I'm not just talking about writing novels. I'm talking about writing, you know, novels that have a very tight page and word count limit and that are pumped out for money.
Yeah.
You know, George R. R. Martin, as frustrating as it's been waiting for him to write his next book, he can afford to go over that, you know, a chapter he's written line by line and take days on it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for other people that are writing as an actual living to get by, it's like, crap, I'm paid by the word and it's got to be done and dusted off to an editor, then for corrections and rewrites, then back to the editor, and then to be published.
Yeah. Needless to say, it's a little more, there's a little more pressure on Blaine to write something, you know? Yeah.
So than... I want to give him the space to be like, I'm not expecting Ulysses.
Exactly. we're not reading Dune here.
Right. Yeah. Although at the same time, when Pardo had written this, writing for Faso was a side gig. You know, he had another full-time job that he did to make his money.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I know, paid him pretty well. And the question then becomes, you know, if you remove the monetary motivation, and this is a labor of love, are the bad habits there simply because that's what he knows? Or is it, he's got to get it done in a word count or a specific time frame.
Yeah. The other thing I wonder too is it the property itself, like BattleTech itself? Because, and the reason I say that, this is a clan book.
Yeah.
How many ways can you effectively write an interesting clan character?
Right. Because it's like, what's their motivation? Well, they have a trial to have a trial to have a trial to maybe get to the point where they're worthy enough to trial for a blood name, and then win the trial to become a con, and then maybe win a trial for a bigger conflict. It's like, ugh.
Yeah, it's like for every Angela Becker that you have, about 50 of them already died.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And, you know, other things that really stuck out, you know, again, like how do you write a clan character? And it seems really common that clan characters almost always have to be dicks to each other.
It's almost like an unspoken rule.
Yeah. And it didn't quite seem that way in the Stackpole or Thurston novels. Mm-hmm. But it really feels obvious here in Roar of Honor, and it feels as though it repeats itself elsewhere.
Yeah.
Like, when I read about Vlad Ward and his conflict with Felon Kell, I get the impression that it comes from more of an actual place of hate, and that then matures into admiration or respect. I should say respect. Admiration is maybe too strong a word, but respect. You sort of have the interaction of between Horse and Aiden Pride, but somehow, you know, out of that Thurston novel, every clan character has to be Joanna.
Yeah, basically. Basically. And I do like Joanna, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
I think Joanna's hilarious.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing that really stands out to me is that Pardo seems to really have a big appreciation for the military pomp and ceremony. And you see that in a couple different places. Again, you see it in Roar of Honor, and you see it in Hour of the Wolf.
Yeah, he sort of understands that decorum that old military officers used to have.
It almost feels like LARPing, though.
Yeah.
You know,
I know what you mean there.
Yeah, it's hard to kind of finagle, but it almost feels like LARPing versus actual decorum.
For a book like this, I to be fair, I think that's fine, because a lot of us BattleTech fans, I mean, you have BattleTech fans that came from, like, the military, too.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But majority of us, I mean, we're all just a bunch of dorks, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Who are into, like, the same stuff like he is. Like, he's a Civil War nerd.
Yeah, so. Well, and, you know, at the same time, too, is, you know, you and I have grown up you know, at a time when what it means to have served in the military is quite different. I mean, I know, you know, military pay, unless you were upper brass, you know, was not great. A lot of people joined the military probably to pay for college, or maybe there was a family tradition. But then, I want to be careful because this could be a huge topic, but like, military recruitment's down. Gee, what could have happened in the past 20 years to change our perspective of what it means to join the military? You know, and I'm not talking about, to be blunt, I'm not talking about the woke, quote unquote, woke stuff or the cancel culture crap. You know, the Afghanistan, Iraq, other military adventurism, the endless wars, the support that individuals get.
Decay of trust between you know, military officers and that too.
I mean, what happens when, you know, you need to be cared for and you don't get the support from the VA? So I think a lot of us grew up seeing that. And so there's a lot of people that are our age or younger that, you know, don't have that military background. People older than us do. Because, I mean, even Jordan Wiseman, I mean, he was it Naval Reserves?
Wiseman? Yeah. I think he was Naval Reserves.
Yeah, I mean, even Forrest Brown and Butch Leiper, who, you know, were big guys who started with TR-0325.
Oh, yeah, I was just going to mention that because you met some of them, too.
Yeah, they served in Vietnam, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think people older than us, maybe many of them did have military experience.
Now, the way, like, we bring up military now, you can kind of see where the problems kind of set in. Like, it with what we know, how do we write a Klan character?
Yeah.
You know, like, the Klan characters don't go through that same thing at all. They're shoved into the military, essentially, and that's it.
Well, and that kind of gets into, you know, a lot of stuff that, I mean, we'll kind of pull back on. And they'll figure it elsewhere because, you know, again, like, the Klan's being fascist. I mean, fascism doesn't benefit anyone unless you're at the very top. Mm-hmm. You know, even its main proponents end up getting hurt themselves by fascism. So that's the whole thing. The other thing I noticed is that, you know, Pardo really loves his references to people and events in history. I was very aware of things like, okay, I know that Pardo is a Civil War nerd.
Yeah.
And he's going to have those references. So I was kind of keeping an eye on stuff. The only one that I really caught my eye was like, oh, that stands out as something that sounds Civil War-ish. Actually wasn't. One of the drop ships is the Featheringham. And I think that was a professor that he had. And so, you know, Pardo likes to make references and call-outs to people that he knows. And I think, you know, Pardo, for how he sometimes has come across on social media, I think he does value his personal relationships. And I think he was making a positive reference. And that's something that's like, oh, you know, that's kind of touching, you know. Good on you, man. Good on you for doing that.
Yeah, it's kind of like when they did the Kickstarter. Picking him to do some of the fiction, obviously, I still think it was a good idea. Mostly for that reason, because we got all those canon characters, man, that were thrown in there.
Yeah.
And it seems like he's the guy who could figure out,
He did do some shitty stuff, though. Did you know that? Like, with Carrie?
Yeah, I did see that, too.
Yeah, so that's not great.
No. I'm not saying that stuff is great. Please, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But I'm saying, like, without any of that, he seems like the guy who could just throw in a bunch of names and, you know, get it out of the way.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. But the other thing that I noticed with Pardo's characters, you know, and again, you know, is it the medium that does this? Although, to be honest, when he did that sort of trilogy, you know, Rock of the Republic, Children of Kerensky, and Hour of the Wolf, you know, he had a lot of page count to give characters more depth, and I don't really feel that he did it. And sometimes it seems almost as though, for Pardo, hobbies are a personality trait, and it's not how that works.
No.
You know, I know, you know, Pardo plays the bagpipes, and he wanted to put probably a little bit of himself into Angela Becker, the protagonist of Roar Runner. And it's like, okay, Angela plays bagpipes. Conquering Terra is all Alaric has thought about since he was a child. Okay, that's not great.
Yeah.
Knife making with Stephanie Kistu in that novella, The Anvil. Now, granted, Stephanie Kistu making knives pays off in a way, but it's not really like, I don't know. It, again, like all these characters are very plain. They're very,
the
to say they're two dimensional is an insult to paper.
Oh God. You know, it's like Alaric, you know, you can't really say like a clan character's good, but his way to do it was like, oh yeah, he likes the Bible. He has a Bible.
Yeah, which made fucking no sense. And that's a whole, again, that's a whole other thing. That's going to be an inevitable thing. There,
but this is leading into what we're doing.
But then, you know, Pardo likes to play his opposites off of each other. And like Hour of the Wolf with Alaric and Malvina, he did the same thing here. You know, Dirk Radek and Angela Becker. You know, Dirk Radek is not just an antagonist. He is a villain. But he's a villain because he's a piece of shit. Versus being just the antagonist, right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, Angela Becker, you know, she's a Mary Sue.
She does everything right. She knows everything, or has the means to learn everything really quick.
She doesn't
seem to move for her.
Yeah, she doesn't really struggle. She doesn't really have a hard time with anything. I mean, at the end, she gets a little upset about something, which we'll get into.
If she does struggle, like, it's not much.
No, no.
It doesn't matter.
And it's just, it's funny because, you know, Mary Sue is a negative connotation, but in a lot of this writing, and Extra Credits on YouTube did a great episode or series of episodes on Heinlein. And when he was younger, he would write a lot of stories for, like, the Boy Scouts, or kids that, you know, were Boy Scouts. And it would be the competent man trope. You know, the guy who's good at everything. He can, you know, plant a farm field, do complicated mathematics, and, you know, fix a car. So that sort of competent man trope is acceptable, but the Mary Sue's not. And it's also funny in today's political climate, what would be acceptable and what wouldn't be. Mm-hmm. But, you know, like Rey Skywalker, she's a Mary Sue. She's a really boring fucking character compared to what she could have been if they had just had a plan for that new trilogy.
Almost hits like the last season of Game of Thrones, you know? Like, yeah. They had so many openings for what they could do. Man, did they whiff.
Yeah, they whiffed.
They whiffed hard.
And so, you know, Angela struggles as that Mary Sue / competent man is pretty boring.
Mm-hmm.
And it also hurts the story, and we'll get into this, but it makes it feel as though all the other characters don't need to be there. If there's too many characters, they are defined very quickly and very plainly.
You could put all of their quirks essentially in like half a sentence.
Yeah.
What you get from each character.
Because Angela is so good at what she does, it's almost as though it doesn't matter that anybody else is there.
No, like she really doesn't need them.
No.
You know?
And that gets us into now
spoilers. Okay. So, obviously, Roar of Honor. I want to at least get out of the way so you know, like, where it takes place. It's 3062, so it's after the Clan invasion. I think that's after...
It's after the refusal, and it's right before the Fed Comm Civil War kicks
off. So we have the Crusader Wolves are the ones that are basically like there right now, you know, because Wolves in Exile they're gone, you know, they're in, what was it, Steiner Space or whatever.
Yeah.
This takes place in 3062. Obviously, Angela Becker against all odds, against, you know, Wolf soldiers on Toffin. She's a rising star. They established that in the beginning because she's, you know, in her clawing ritual.
Yeah.
Basically, like, she's chosen by the Khans to create her own unit, her own trinary of warriors, and she has, like, you know, all the codexes she needs. She gets to build everything together based off of their set of skills. She brings them all together, and this is pretty much the whole setting for Roar of Honor. They don't know why they're there. They don't know what they're doing. but competent Rye star. Angela Becker is the hero, and she can bring the troops together, rally them together, and do what is the best for Clan Ghostbear.
Yeah.
That is pretty much the whole premise of this book. So yeah, like you said, you have Angela Becker, who is your rising star. You know, she plays the bagpipes. She's your, she could do everything. Your Mary Sue, you know. And it opens up,
with the clawing ritual.
Her and her clawing ritual, which, you know, honestly, as a Clan Ghostbear fan, freaking awesome. You know, it's cool to see, like, all right, we're getting a clawing ritual. Let's go. Let's see what happens. They're in a cave.
Yeah. And what happens throughout this book is that there's kind of two ongoing parallels. There is Angela, the ghost bear warrior, as kind of like a ghost bear in the sense of the patience predator, the one that camps and waits for the opportunity.
Like, she's the stereotypical, like, totem warrior. You know, like, for everything you would expect about a ghost bear.
Yeah.
And that's what she is.
There's also the parallel of Angela Becker and one of the warriors she recruits named Bethany, but we'll circle back to that later. But yeah, I did not like this first chapter because, I mean, I see what Pardo is going for, but I feel he fumbles it because it's so important that the clawing ritual is completed that Pardo kind of breaks what the ghost bear is to make this happen.
Yes. Because in Battletech, the ghost bear is not like a scavenger or anything. It is a solitary creature. It just hides. It like almost hibernates under snow and it just waits for prey. And as they get close, you know, it strikes real quick, kills whatever's there, eats it, and it's done. Like, that's basically how a ghost bear operates. And the way he does it, it ends up sounding more like a shark or, like, some other, like, animal.
Yeah.
It's really strange. So, you'd have a better way to explain it, because I know you had more of a problem with
how it
was presented than I did.
So what ends up happening is that Angela and one of her companions, whom she later recruits into the Trinary, they're on the clawing ritual. You know, Angela's already blood named here. Her companion, he gets injured. He's like death's fucking door. Probably the only thing that's saving him is like low grade medical hypothermia.
Dude's already got mauled, you know.
So she pulls him into the cave and she knows she can't give up, right? And of course, it's the first chapter of this story. Like, there's no way she's gonna lose this, right?
She could have, but
she makes the decision to cut off two of her fingers, which is like, I have personally sliced my finger open from tip to cuticle with a knife. How do you do anything? Trying to actually cutting your fingers off the joint. Like, she's not Yakuza here, right?
I've had my fingers run through a belt on a dental vacuum, which pretty much is, like, tight like a car belt, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know how I didn't chop my fingers off.
Yeah.
They did not chop off, but it fucking hurt.
Yeah. Like, the idea that you're going to just keep doing what you're doing, I guess, right? It's just,
I suppose if enough adrenaline kicked in. But,
so she takes the two fingers. Well, she obviously stops the bleeding, but she takes the two fingers and she dangles them outside the cave wall or the cave opening and just tosses them out into the snow. And then a ghost bear comes and then she sets her spear, you know, in like a brace position and then the ghost bear dives on it and dies. What kind of gets to me is one, you know, the ghost, how do they even get to this fucking cave without triggering a ghost bear? You know, it's not like the fingers were like tossed out and dripped blood everywhere, you know, for 100 feet. Also, it's snowing and it's windy and it's blowing and it just, who's going to pick up this scent? But it means that a ghost bear did not become, a sedentary hunter. It actually smelled the fingers, got up, tracked to the cave door and burst in and it wasn't just sitting and lying in wait. And then the of course it raises the question of, well, what does a ghost bear eat? Are you telling me that there's no other animal that they would have come across that would have been like, oh, hey, fingers, and, you know, followed, you know, into, mm-hmm. you know, into the cave? You know, no, it was a ghost bear. So that's one of those things that kind of got to me, is that, you know, Angela throughout the story adopts sort of the ghost bear mentality of, you know, she's outnumbered, she's outgunned, she's going to lie in wait, she's going to set traps, you know, she's going to set and spring ambushes. You know, she is going to adopt the mentality of the ghost bear. And even though that wasn't spelled out explicitly, it's a pretty obvious parallel, you know, what she's doing. You know, ghost bear waits. You know, ghost bear waits for the right opportunity. Mm-hmm. Angela's going to wait for the right opportunity, you know, considering what she's dealing with. Chapter one, the ghost bear is not doing what a ghost bear does.
No, it isn't.
And I know what he's doing. He's doing like a Michael Bay, setting the scene, making a big action thing. I get it. But that really was like, this is not right. And I get why he did it, but it really bothered me. And maybe it bothered me more than it should. Maybe someone out there is going to say it's nitpicking, but it's like, there was maybe something better she could have done. But you know, in the end, it's like, okay, Angela's more ghost bear than the ghost bear.
Yeah, and I mean, not to mention, too, like, she
ghost bears harder than ghost bears.
Yeah, ghost bear hard. See, she has the guy with her, too, Sprange, and the dude is, like, it's described, like, he's mauled, so, like, the dude's bleeding, you know? Yeah. Like, he already smells of blood and, like, everything that animal would want, so it's almost like, why did she have to cut off her fingers?
Yeah.
Couldn't she have just thrown him out of the cage?
Or just take, like, one of his bandages?
Right?
But no.
Bethany older me caught that.
Yeah. Angela has to be a badass, and, you know, Bethany does her thing later that kind of mimics that, and yeah. So that was one of the things that really stuck out to me, is, like, this is one of the main parallels that he tries to establish, and it.
Already I'm like, yeah, cool, we got a nice action scene, and you're already like, oh no, this is setting the tone, isn't it?
Yeah.
This is what I'm getting into.
Yeah.
And then I'm sitting in the back just like kind of chuckling about it, because I know what it's going to get to.
Right. You know, and that's one of those things that really stuck out to me with that opening chapter. And I know it may bother me too much, but that's just one of those things. I was like, okay, yeah. You know, here we're at.
The one that did it for me was the second chapter. Yeah. It was the second one when they were getting, was a constant thing. And his bondsman, Barthello. And, okay, so it's obviously known by a lot of clan fans, like, how the whole bondsman system works. They're basically prisoners of war, and long story short, they're basically beaten to submission to become part of the clan.
Yeah.
Like, there's no other way to really put it.
A Stockholm Syndrome thing. Or, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this poor dude, like, the first thing, when Barthello's introduced, he uses a contraction, and this guy is, like, beating on him. Like, making Barthello, like, feel terrible. And I expect that, like, with the clans, because that's, like, how they are.
Mm-hmm.
But you would think Angela Becker, being a main character of a story, like, she probably would have stepped in and be like, hey, ease down a little bit, buddy. Yeah. No, she's, like, admiring the guy for doing this.
Well, I know you haven't probably listened to too many of them yet, but, you know, for listeners out there, if you ever get the chance, one of my favorite podcasts is Behind the Bastards.
Mm-hmm.
Robert Evans, and every once in a while, like, especially when he does like the Nazi episodes or something like that, you know, there'll always be that one guy. It's like, hey, you know, it's that one Nazi, like, hey, you got to take it down a notch. Like,
yeah, like you'd think she would have been that one.
Yeah. Like the Nazi who goes to like Imperial Japan is like, holy shit, these guys are racist. You know, you'll get lots of examples of that. And it's just, you would think like somewhere, someone, yeah. Would, you know,
we're going to be ghost bears waiting and hiding a long time for that to happen.
Yeah.
But that's one that got me. And even in that same chapter, they drop indentured servant, and the way it was portrayed in there, like it was super simple, you know, and it rubbed me the wrong way. Like the whole scene.
Yeah.
Because even Stackpole, with the way he portrays like his clan characters, they're bad. Don't get me wrong. Like Vlad, like he's a badass, but
well, Vlad, I don't like Vlad's complicated. I actually enjoy reading Vlad because, yes, you know, Vlad is arrogant. He does display hubris, which gets him in trouble, but it's not like Shakespearean or Greek tragedy hubris where he ends up getting himself killed.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Vlad is enjoyable to read because he's not just an absolute monster, you know, the same way Smoke Jaguar characters were.
Yeah. Vlad, you get this, like, almost like what you thought, like, Angela Becker was going to be if you're writing, a strong clan character, you know? Like, that's what you would kind of expect. It's just, but Angela being a ghost bear, ghost bears are a little more liberal when it comes to freeborns.
Yeah.
Like the wolves, too.
Yeah.
You know, even Crusader wolves, like, they were bad, too. Like, most other, well, you know, just to be fair, all clans are terrible to freebirds. But you have your clans in, like tier A, they're, like, okay with them, and then it gets worse. Ghost Bear's at the top, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I get the impression, although I haven't read too much of the fiction, but, you know, by the Dark Age, with the integration of the Free Razzle Republic and the Kongsarme with the Ghost Bears, it's a much different system. It probably is like a two-track system to a degree, but I'm sure there's a lot more respect and bleed over.
Oh yeah, they had problems, but the thing is, the Ghost Bears with the mindset that they have, they would have struggled a lot less, as they have. That's why they were like one of the first clans to actually like become like part of the Inner Sphere.
Yeah, yeah.
Like on their own terms.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
If not, maybe the only. No. No, don't hold me to that. But her attitude should have been way different about it. Like she, like we were saying, like she would have been like, "Hey, tone it down."
Yeah,
that's what I immediately thought. But yeah, like it even like escalates to, it gets worse than that. That was my only problem with like the second chapter.
Yeah,
that one stood out to me.
We're not doing a chapter by chapter.
No,
things that like caught our eyes. It was like, okay, that doesn't sit well
with me. I just felt it's good to bring these up now because this is what's setting the tone for the book.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And, you know, what I noticed is that there were things that bothered me in the beginning and things that bothered me towards the end, but not a lot in the middle that was like, eh. And I think a lot of that comes down to, and this maybe I should have remembered to say this in the previous section, but one of the things that really strikes me about Pardoe is that although I'm no longer like crazy about him as a writer, I will say that what he writes tends to be a quick read. You know, it doesn't get bogged down in a lot of gunk.
And that is not a bad thing.
Yeah, it moves at a pretty good pace, at a very good clip. And he's, you know, some of the books are worse than this, and some of the books he's written are better at this. But in general, War of Honor was a pretty fast read. So while I didn't, I know you liked it more than I did. I wasn't really crazy about it. I mean, if I were to grade the book, it'd be like a C-. It moved pretty fast. And so a lot of the middle of the book, I think, moves at a pretty good pace. But yeah, the beginning and the end had, you know, the majority of the problems I had with it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I know there was another thing you had a problem with, and that was the scene with the doctor.
Yeah, yeah. And I definitely want to get into that. I mean, one of the things I did want to say before that, because as we're going kind of like through the book from beginning to end, one of the things that really stands out is, you know, Pardoe does like to repeat himself. You know, yes. And part of it's kind of like the Chekhov gun thing. You know, the idea that in Act 1, you have this gun. In Act 2, it gets mentioned again. By Act 3, it better fire. You know, that sort of thing. Because you want to lay that groundwork for it. So nothing really kind of comes out of nowhere. This is maybe what made the first couple of Harry Potter books good reads. And I think by book 4, she kind of loses the plot a little bit. But, you know, she does these sort of mystery novels.
Mm-hmm.
That's really kind of what she does, actually, with just the dressing of kids and wizardry and OSHA violations.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what Pardoe does is he kind of repeats this sort of trueborn, freeborn rivalry and dynamic, and particularly emphasizes it with Grigori and Bethany. And you know, Grigori is the freeborn warrior. Ideally, you're getting kind of attached to him because he's kind of a funny guy. And then Dirk Raddick comes in, who is somewhat genocidal, and will kill any freeborn mech warrior he gets a chance to do so, just straight up kill him. And you think, oh no, is Grigori going to be in trouble? And never in the fucking book does it feel like Grigori is actually going to be in that much trouble.
No.
But yeah, Pardo like repeats things a lot. And we see that particularly in his book, Forever Faithful. He repeats a lot of the stuff in there over and over and over and over again. It's like, dude, I got it the third fucking time. Why are we doing this the fifth fucking time? Like,
yes.
Especially when that book, speaking about pacing, is paced so poorly, whereas War of Honor is, I think, paced relatively well.
Yeah, when Blaine is sort of constricted to, like, I guess you would call it, like, a one-lane road, you know, where he could just move in a straight shot, like, he's good. Like, he can do simple novels like this. You know, while I still have it on my brain, when you brought up Dirk Raddick, he was the other character I really had a problem with. Yeah. And it wasn't because of the way... I mean, obviously, he's a bad guy, like, we're supposed to hate him. But you have other characters like Joanna or like Vlad, like you brought up. Like, you can actually enjoy them.
Yeah, like, I like Joanna's character because I understand her motivations. Yeah.
Dirk?
He's just a dick.
He's just an ass. Like, he just kills freeborns because he wants to. And then he goes back, like, he tones it down a little. He's like, well, technically, no, he does it because he likes to make other people think he's, like, rash. But at the same time, it's like, does he need to kill him to freaking do that, though?
Yeah.
You know, like, couldn't he just, like, beat him up? I mean, that's
better than killing him. You see that parallel, too. You know, Alaric Wolff, Angela Becker.
Mm-hmm.
Melvina Hazen, Dirk Raddick.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
the Tanker Crew.
Yeah. You see these parallels. And, I mean, especially, like, Melvina Hazen is, like, to the extent of what Dirk Raddick... You see that line both in the characters that Pardo writes and where that sort of philosophy goes and becomes. And really some of the main differences I feel is that, you know, Dirk Raddick controls his cluster by fear, because he kind of can, because he's the one in command and he can kind of do that. And it's a big abusive relationship.
But he also tells you he's a cunning and, you know, like, good warrior, like,
and he's totally not at all.
No, like, he's not. The book. But he does tell you that. So yeah, yeah. That means he is.
And that's he takes stupid pills because the plot needs him to take stupid fucking pills. And he, it's just one of those things. Like, you, off the gate, I mean, you understand exactly who he is, and it's not because of clever writing. It's because of very simple. Like, he's the bad guy. We're gonna make him evil, and. He did
the Cobra Commander reveal. Yeah,
the only fucking difference between Dirk Raddick and Melvina Hazen is really that because Melvina Hazen is a woman and a female character, that means she gets to use her sexuality for control and evil,
mm-hmm.
which is not a good look.
No, not a good look. Not true, you know.
But I mean, that's one of those things, is that repeatability is that you would think that there would be more with that trueborn-freeborn conflict in the book, and it really doesn't feel as though it ever plays out.
No, it doesn't feel like it. But yeah, I'm glad we rolled back the dirt, because he did bug me. And he doesn't even grow on me as, like, a villain. Like, he's just a really boring, stereotypical villain.
Right. You know, if I want a good villain, like, one of my favorite villains is Megatron from the Beast Wars series. Because he's so good. And part of that's the voice actor, whose name, unfortunately, I can't remember. But he's so great. He's so good. I just love him. And, you know, good villains can be just simply, you know, evil. They can be selfish. They can be self-involved. And you don't have to like every villain. I mean, the sort of... justification is one thing. Making a villain sympathetic is another. Don't always have to do those things. But, you know, Dirk is almost comical in his assholishness. And it doesn't really help the book at all.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. I mean, if you want to, talk about favorite villains too a little bit, like, I mean, Ramsay Bolton, man, like you have to hate him, but he's written so good that you have to hate the guy. You know, like he's just terrible.
Dan's fucking weird.
I know I'm weird, but like he's such a shitbag. He is just such a shitbag that, ugh. But I mean that's how you make like a villain you just have to hate.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's why I love the character, because like you freaking hate him so much. but I don't get that vibe with Dirk at all.
Yeah,
why does he do that to Freeborns? If it was Smoke Jaguar, it'd be easy, because it's like it's Smoke Jaguar. But this is Wolf.
And the funny thing is, you know, in the universe, you know, Dirk Radek ends up joining the Republic of the Sphere, like with the Jihad. You know, so I don't know in that regard, like what else has been written regarding Dirk? Because again, a lot of that stuff existed in a time when Fossa had closed its doors, WizKids was having the Dark Age novels written, and Media Res, who is like the parent company of CGL, and then before that FanPro, did not actually have the rights to make novels. That's why they had the Battlecore short story website. Mm-hmm. And so what actually happened with Dirk, I don't know. Like, you know, is this Dirk the Dirk that then became something else? Or is this almost like the mirror universe Dirk that didn't actually exist except in this novel, and the Dirk that actually became a paladin is actually an okay guy? I don't know.
I'd be curious to know how he turned into that.
Yeah, and that might be in those hot spots source books that I've got to finish going through. They might be in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so like, yeah, Dirk... Ugh. But yeah, I know the other scene that really stuck out to you was the one with her doctor.
And I this is one of those things that kind of gets into the editing part. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you just want me to.
Well, we were kind of trying to do was kind of go down the line through the book. So like the next thing past Dirk would probably be the doctor thing.
I mean, there were a couple other odds and ends, but like mostly like maybe it's nitpicking. But like the doctor thing though doesn't really feel like nitpicking. That kind of plays back into the competent man Mary Sue trope, and why, you know, editing's important and why it feels like so many of these characters really aren't necessary. So there's a chapter, and I can't remember what chapter it is, but basically, you know, they're on Toffin. Angela's got her crew. She's training them really, really hard. And there's this doctor there who used to be the paramour of the previous garrison commander.
Mm-hmm.
And so Dr. Drogon, he may be a freeborn, but he's still a doctor. And he kind of throws his weight around in a way that most Klansmen probably wouldn't enjoy.
Yeah, and Angela...
She initially is irritated by this.
Yeah, she's irritated, but she's a little more tolerant, which is why they eventually start getting along a little, if you want to call it that.
But it's sort of, we missed this really easy opportunity to make something work a bit more naturally. And what ends up happening is, you know, Bethany's starting to work these guys hard, trying to get them trained, and they're not having days off, and they're starting to make mistakes, and... The elemental warrior, whose name I can't remember. Dolph. Dolph gets injured by Bethany. Now, Bethany's a hothead, and she injures Dolph probably because she made a bad mistake, and they're also probably getting tired. And when they come back, Angela has already recognized and says to herself, I need to give these guys time off. I've worked them really hard. They deserve a rest finally. And then Drogon comes up and says, hey, you've been working these guys too hard. They need a rest. And it's so unnecessary, unless the idea is that they're all on the same wavelength.
Or he's implying like she has the intuition of a doctor.
Yeah.
Or something, you know?
It's unnecessary to even have a chapter in that sequence, because Angela's already made the conclusion. She already knows that she's been working them too hard. They need a rest. The last half of that chapter does nothing. What I posit, which would have been much better for Angela, because you know, you chip away at her Mary Sue-ishness, mm-hmm. her competent man-ishness, if you change the sequence of events here and you make her grow as a character to rely not just to be a team leader and a team builder, but to rely on her team because she's picked them for a reason, because they can do things that she can't do. So what would have been better would have been if Drogon had approached her at the beginning of the chapter and said, hey, I've been monitoring and doing physical exams on these guys and paying attention to them, and I'm recognizing that they're getting worn down, they're getting injured, they're not recovering fast enough, they're getting sloppy, they're making mistakes that they wouldn't make if they had a full rest.
Yeah.
You know, because we've all been there. You know, you work too hard over the weekend and you get into Monday, you know, like you're doing too many stuff around the, too many things around the house, you didn't actually rest, you can't do anything, or you work really hard Monday through Friday, you think, okay, I got a plan, I'm going to do all the things I want to get done on a Saturday that I've been putting off, and you wake up and you're like, nope, I'm not getting out of bed.
Yeah. Doesn't matter if you're a clan warrior, whatever, you still need your rest, man.
Yeah. And so it would have been good if Drogon had approached Angela Becker at the beginning of that chapter and said, hey, as a doctor, I'm telling you, you need to give your mech warriors and elementals a rest because they're going to start making mistakes and they're going to injure themselves mm-hmm. and then they're not going to be able to recover. And she blows them off. And then on the training exercise, Bethany, because she's also tired and she's already predisposed to making mistakes, injures Dolph, the elemental point leader, and he gets really, really hurt and is laid up in sickbay. And on the way back, Angela can sit there and think, you know what? I was warned.
Yeah.
And it's important for me as a team leader to take the advice of my team and consider it and put it to good use, because I am not a Mary Sue that can do everything.
Yeah.
And then that grows a relationship between
her and the doctor.
Her and the doctor. And then maybe that even helps grow a relationship with Bethany, because maybe Bethany feels remorse because she injured a teammate. Because Bethany already comes into this story also being like a loner and pissed off in general. And then maybe that helps Dolph do something else too. So there was a lot of things that could have happened from this, because I mean, we've all been there. We're like, you know, like, something goes wrong at work and you feel awful about it, and you put your heart on the line, and the person that you injured or hurt in some way opens up to you too, and you've developed a relationship. And that would have been so cool. But no, we didn't do that. We didn't, and it's really easy. Like, to me, it seems so obvious. Like, yes, you can do these things and you can have this happens, therefore, but something line of events. Instead, it's, well, Angela already knows what's going on. She already knows what's happening. Yeah. It's time to give everyone a rest.
It's like that instead of her actually learning a valuable lesson, which would have been so much freaking better, it's just the doctor learning a lesson that
Angela's amazing.
And she's just so great. You know, yeah. She came to the same conclusion as me. That must mean I'm a good doctor. Yeah. You know, opposed to like something more human to me, which would have been like you described.
Yeah.
You know, like her actually learning like, oh wow, you know, maybe I should listen to doctors or like my technicians and that.
Yeah. Yeah. And it feels like a missed opportunity. It feels like something they could have done.
Yeah. And it would have shown a lot more like the struggles that the actual clanners go through.
Yeah.
You know, having that contrast between the different castes.
And it's important too, because Angela eventually becomes a Khan. Not in this book, obviously, but she eventually does. And that means if you're going to become a Khan, if you want to be a successful Khan,
you don't just tell everyone what to do.
Yeah.
You know?
You know, because I mean, you kind of compare that to what we see macro scale in the universe. You know, you see Venda Von Kistu, you see Elias Critchell, who are arch crusaders and Jade Falcon warriors. They fuck up immensely and they get killed
by Black Ward.
Yeah. You see the Smoke Jaguars, who have repeatedly been 100% absolutely awful to their lower castes, and at times let them die because of starvation. And then when other clans came in to, you know, do trials of possession for enclaves of lower castmen, the Smoke Jaguars are like, well, I'm going to burn it down because you can't have my lower castmen. I'm just going to let them starve. Or to the point where they mismanaged their economy so badly that they had to develop proto-mech technology because they couldn't keep making mechs.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you have these obvious things. Like, if Angela's going to become a Khan, like, let her become a better
person. Let her get a few scars other than the ones she caused on herself. Right. You know?
Right.
Like, have somebody else put a couple scars on her.
Yeah.
You know, I think a Rystar is more interesting if they actually evolve from events that don't favor them and, like, come out of it, like, scathed.
Like Vlad fucking Ward.
Like, because, Vlad, man.
Because he was pissed off and arrogant and hated Freeborns.
And then he breaks off a cast and beats the shit out of a...
yeah, out of a Khan.
And he's evolved into the badass that he is because of the conflicts that he's had. You know, he's learned the hard way. Angela hasn't had that. This was the opportunity to have that. And you blew it.
So I feel like it was a really easy opportunity and it was missed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of one of the things you see with Pardo's writing is that, like, those really clever things that maybe you don't recognize. It's like the red letter media. Like, you didn't recognize it, but your brain did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you may not have recognized it, but on your read through, it would have felt more fulfilling and satisfying.
I like to think this is something that came out, like, maybe it was missed or something, like it was a screw up in editing, and Blaine, like, it comes out, and maybe Blaine was like, "Ah, damn it, that's not what I wanted."
Well, it could have been. He, you know, you read through it, you know, again, and he's like, "Oh yeah, I should have fixed that. I could have made that better."
I'm pretty sure that's probably happened a handful of times, man.
Oh, it happens to probably everybody, right?
You know, that got me. The other one I wanted to bring up too, which I think happens after this, is with Netta, the Nova Cat. Warrior that's in the ranks. So she is written like your stereotypical Nova Cat warrior, you know, visions, like she can sort of like kind of predict the future in that. And this mysticism does come up, I believe twice in the book. The first time she does it, doesn't she allude to like what's going to happen to Bethany, or like comes up with like how she's going to be a problem?
Yeah. I mean, it, but she encourages it because it's important
to her growth.
But it's weird, right? Because like the Nova Cat vision thing, it feels out of place in what's supposed to be a relatively hard science fiction. But at the same time, I get what's going on. Like, it is leaving room for these kinds of things, but it doesn't really make a difference.
Yeah. Should have been a Goliath scorpion with the drugs, man.
Yeah.
It's so much better.
Well, because, she's like, oh, yeah, you know, some sort of vision about, you know, wolf stalking a bear or whatever. And then rather than being prepared, you know, Clan Wolf shows up at, Nadir or Zenith jump point, and it doesn't fucking matter because they got 7 days to prepare anyway. You know, whatever.
But she's Nova Cat, and she warned them, you know. And they do the same. He does basically the same thing later in the book too.
Well, the same thing in, you know, Forever Faithful, you know, over and over again with the whole Nova Cat thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Trent was made into a Nova Cat.
Yeah.
You know, to hide his identity.
Yeah.
It's almost like he had an obsession with Nova Cat, and I get it because, you know, some clans have some cool little quirks to them. Yeah. You know.
I mean, bear in mind, I did like Exodus Road. Because I felt Trent's motivations were completely understandable and justified.
That's a good Blaine book.
And the people that didn't like Trent just fucking want to line up Smoke Jaguar dick and suck him off like a circus seal.
Dude, you could...
yeah, I said that.
Yeah, there you go. But yeah, like Trent as a character, like you could relate to him even as like a disgruntled like worker, you know.
Yeah.
Like at that level, it's just like this dude, you know, he's like, hey, I'm doing everything right and this clan is just such a piece of shit that I can't get anywhere. I mean, it almost sounds like Blaine was probably working at like some company or something. He was just like sick of it.
Yeah.
Like that's the vibe. I like, you kind of get that from Trent, and that's one of the reasons I enjoyed Exodus Road, you know.
Yeah.
You could relate to them a lot more. Even like Paul Moon even evolves more as a character. But you don't get that vibe with Angela. But, you know, again, like, this is a one-off book.
Yeah, yeah. And I know there were a couple things I wanted to bring up before we get to the big thing, the piece de resistance for the novel that I know you really want to get into. Mm-hmm. But there were just a couple of odd things. It's like, okay, you know, did this happen because we didn't actually have this fluffed out, or did Blaine just make a mistake? And it's hard to say because so many of his last novels were just full of, you know, fucking typos and continuity errors. But, like, you know, some of it was, you know, so one of the mech warriors, his name was Breedfelt, and they just mentioned this offhandedly, like, oh, yeah, you know, he's piloting a Kodiak, which he knows inside and out because he was part of the design team. It's like, dude, it's 3062, and the Kodiak went into production in 3001, right? Was that just not fluffed out? Because I know the Kodiak debuted in TRO 3058, and the Kingfisher, I think, debuted in one of the books before 58, but it was republished in 3058. And they mentioned that with the Kingfisher too. So, what do they say? Like, oh yeah, the Kingfisher is a newer type of Omnimac, but it went into production in 2887. So, again, was that just one of those things that it was never written down anywhere? You know, even back in the depths of FOSSA, they didn't have it planned out.
Yeah,
was he just making just like random factoids that would hopefully become
like the old later? Guard.
Oh God, yeah.
You know, like the old guard.
Yeah, the old guard. Ugh.
I could defend him on this one because I'm almost positive all that stuff is retcon later.
Yeah.
About the Kodiak and Kingfisher and that. Because a lot of the new Omnimech dates, manufacturers, all of that came out at like almost the end of was it Herb's era
in BattleTech? Yeah, I remember
he and Ben Rome had almost like this mission to go back and just like flesh everything out.
Yeah.
Which is why we got all those updated rule books and that.
Yeah. The TRO upgrades, I think, did a lot of really cool mm-hmm. things with fleshing out the original 3050 Omnimax.
It's interesting, though, to see even like how maybe at the time they wanted these things to be new designs, but as they started to maybe throw them out there, you know, like they had to start retconning this stuff back. Maybe it could have been because of poor communication between their authors, you know, whatever it could have been. It's interesting to see that in like its place and time, you know.
Yeah, I mean, BattleTech has not been in any ways, you know, forever etched or poured into concrete. I mean, even some of the development of new technology, for example, in the historical war 30 to 39, and what that actually means for many of the upgraded designs in TRO 3050 versus how it was portrayed in much of the Blood of Kerensky trilogy
mm-hmm.
and the original TRO 3050. So, yeah, I mean, you're right. Yeah, you're right. I mean, you got to give him some leeway because who actually knows what was written down when he was creating this book? It was one of those things that stood out, like, okay, maybe we shouldn't be so eager to do things. And he does that in Hour of the Wolf. You know, out mm-hmm. of nowhere, he dropped the acronym for SAVE.
Yeah.
And then they took it out in the later editions. Like, no, dude, you weren't supposed to do that. It's not supposed to be a thing.
I mean, the old guard was added essentially after he wrote that book.
Well, which was him, you know, again, being a military buff. And, you know, he loved the Napoleonic Civil War probably as well, just like the Civil War, because I think they're roughly around the same era. And he was putting a reference in to the old guard from, you know, Napoleonic France.
Mm-hmm.
So he's like, let's do that here. And it doesn't land well.
No, it doesn't. But you know,
well, and you know, to also get to this one point too with parallels, to circle back all the way to the beginning of this with parallels with Bethany, you know, and it kind of gets the whole idea of, you know, the clans are fascist and fascism doesn't benefit anyone, and
including their warriors,
especially their warriors.
Yeah.
But you know, Angela and Bethany are often given as parallels because, you know, Angela is trying to, I don't know, it sounds bad, like break Bethany like a horse.
And Bethany doesn't want to be her.
Right.
You know.
But then eventually Bethany does become her, even down to like the replaced fingers. But in much of, because, you know, fascism doesn't allow questioning of authority, because therefore you're not sufficiently fascist.
Mm-hmm.
And although in the military, you know, there is the whole point of following orders, but there's also this idea that, you know, maybe orders should be justified. Otherwise, you know, who knows what's going to happen, and should be reasoned out. And, you know, Bethany asks questions, and she asks questions a lot. And it comes up a couple of times. You know, Angela's like, well, I'm told to do what I do, and that's why I'm a Ristar and why I'm blood named, because I follow orders and I achieve the goal and I make it happen. And, you know, Bethany questions a lot of things, but Angela never does. And it does come up several times throughout the book of, why are they on Toffin? Why did they pull a whole cluster off of Toffin, packed it full of supplies, and just left a green trinary to hold it? Like, what the fuck? In the end, we do find out why that happened. And, you mm-hmm. know, Angela had never thought to ask the questions, and she never had, you know, sufficiently explored it. And then she ended up getting burned because she was never supposed to succeed. Mm-hmm. You know, she was supposed to be, Toffin was supposed to be too enticing of a target and taken by Clan Wolf so the Ghost Bears could take three planets from the Wolves at the same time, because Dirk Radek moved his cluster out of position and there wasn't anyone to protect those worlds.
Mm-hmm. It was a clever idea.
It was a clever idea, but Bethany didn't know that she was supposed to just, you know, be bait. And if she had known that, it would have been a different story. Like, maybe she could have known, like, I just have to go to ground for a long time.
You know, if you knew you were going to be bait, like, you were talking about not just, like, a throwaway clan warrior here. I mean, all of them are throwaway.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you got a Rise Star, right?
Yeah.
Wouldn't you, like, if Rising Stars are generally the ones that become the top tiers of the clans.
Well, and it definitely doesn't seem as though Angela had pissed anybody off, that it was, like, a political calculation to move her there.
No, they just, like, they threw her into it, and you would think, information is ammunition, right?
Yeah.
Like, you would want to know what you're getting into.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it, that could have been played out a bit differently. But, I mean, part of that, and I think,
what's she going to do, Adam? Say no?
Right, right. And I feel as though that parallel between Angela and Bethany about Bethany's questioning orders, Angela's not. And at the end, Angela realizes maybe she should have questioned the orders. Maybe she should have done more work and more pushback.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that's a bit more successful.
Yeah.
That parallel versus Angela and the Ghost Bear.
And that was the only part in the book, which is sad, where, like, she kind of learned a lesson.
Yeah.
Because even then, like, she does grow as a human being. And we get the Ghost Bear trope. Like, she chooses to stay with her family.
Yes. Yes. You know? Yes. Yes. And she loses faith in the institution, which is kind of similar to Alaric losing faith in himself at the end of Hour of the Wolf.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that was more successful. And I think I would have liked to have seen that explored more.
Yeah.
And I feel like that worked out really well. Although there were problems overall with it, that Angela-Bethany comparison and how it plays out the end, that works.
And the thing is, like, that whole thing is not really alluded to. Like, how she's going to learn it, like, it just kind of, like, happens in the end. Like, it's just all revealed, and she just learns about how crappy everything is.
Yeah, I think another read-through, I think it'll stick out a bit more, you know, now that we've played it out.
Because I didn't really get, like, there were a couple hints, like, sort of dropped, but you didn't get this impression that...
So you're not being browbeat with this one.
Yeah.
You know, though the whole, like, the way he brings up the Trueborn Freeborn thing over and over again, and then it doesn't go anywhere.
No, it really doesn't. There's no tension. Like, what's going to happen to the Freeborns, like, if they lose? Like, you would think Angela would be a little more motivated to protect them.
Yeah.
You know, but... Again, like, that was another thing that could have humanized her a lot more, but we didn't get that.
No. So yeah, and that's the end of my notes. I know you still got a bunch more, and I know we're getting close to the big thing we want to discuss.
So before we get to the big reveal, the main thing, like, I really liked was, like, I know I talked about how Bethello was, like, basically getting his ass beat in a submission to join the clan. But what I did like his arc, because he sort of got his, like, his reek moment, you know, like, where they're like, hey, you know what, dude? There's a Viper that we're going to need for this battle. Go get it. So, like, he, before getting, like, the cord cut or anything, essentially, if you want to say that, Angela's the one who's trusting the Freeborn to go get the mech and join in on the battle.
Yeah.
Opposed to the, you know, his actual, like, what is it? The bondsman like owner.
Oh, Constant Sing.
Yeah, I know Constant Sing, but what do they call it?
Oh,
that's what I'm like stuck on. I could cut off.
Well, there's space. I know there's a lot of that vocabulary, like the bondsraff and bondsman and all that stuff. But yeah, I know what you mean. Like she kind of took command of that situation and maybe overstepped her bounds by ordering him to do it without necessarily getting permission from.
I just got hung up over what the terminology was. But yeah, essentially, like, I did like that arc because it was cool to see, like, a freeborn kind of get his, a bondsman, I should say, like, kind of get his reward in the end.
You don't really
care about that too much unless it's, like, the obvious, like, Phelan Kell, you know.
Yeah, and one of the things that kind of gets to me about the whole bond system, once you start getting Inner Sphere characters involved, is that unless you're Phelan Kell, you know, what really is the motivation to do this? Is it to join the society? Is it you don't get the shit kicked out of you all the time?
You don't want to die?
You don't, yeah.
Is that really just the motivator?
Right. You know, like, what do the clans have? Well, they can regrow your limbs, and if you're lucky, you can have a lot of unattached sex. But other than that, you know, what is there? I mean,
you're answering to everybody. Depending on where you're at.
Yeah.
It's not fun.
And so, yeah, I mean, is the only motivation to do the job and not become a bondsman is that so you don't get the crap kicked out of you all the time?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess that doesn't really feel very awesome.
But he got set free.
He did get set free.
I will gladly accept that for Barthello. You go, man.
Yeah.
You get that Viper and you probably lose it in the next conflict when a better or some warrior kills you. Or maybe he becomes like Horse.
Maybe.
That's possible. He becomes a smartass. He starts, you know, getting his kill tally up.
I mean, one of the things with Pardo is that the ideas for these characters are there. Like, there's like, there's probably too many characters in this book. And they're not really given enough time because there are so many characters. But if you read some of the scenario books that Pardo wrote, you know, he's really good at giving, you know, creating characters and giving them ideas of what they're like. And he does that better in these, you know, two or three paragraphs that he's given for the scenario books than he is with novels, which is really weird and frustrating. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it would have been interesting to see what do some of these characters go on to do.
Yeah.
Especially Bart as a, you know, I'm just gonna call him Bart.
Bart, yeah.
As a freeborn warrior from the Inner Sphere.
Now that we're calling him Bart, I just imagine saying being like Homer, just grabbing him. Why are you little?
Constant, yeah. Just
how dare you use contractions?
Yeah.
But the book wasn't that fire, but there was one scene.
There was one scene that was pretty lit. Fire. It's pretty lit.
Pretty lit. I was just waiting for you to get to it.
Yeah.
And I even talked about it when we went on about our for a little bit that we did. Yeah. But yeah, there's a fire in this book. They set a field on fire as a distraction or, you know, as tactics to help them in their battle.
I do think, and I know I mentioned this to you before too, is I do feel that this worked better than it did in our.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Because,
and not just like it was more effective, it's just like on a literary level.
Yeah, because when you take, it seems like when you take Blaine, like I said, if you constrict him, like you compact him a little bit into like a little area, like he does great. And this fire battle was a lot better, way better than the one in our.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. There was actual like tension in that going on. But
yeah, because in the rest of the book, there doesn't, even though there's a couple of fights that Angela loses, it never feels as though she's actually in danger.
Mm-hmm.
And there was tension here, but at the same time, it wasn't really in doubt what was going to happen to Angela, you know?
Yeah, you knew she was going to pull through.
Yeah.
You really did. But the fire battle had more utility in this book than it did in Hour of Wolf.
Oh, totally.
You know? Now the reason they got to use the fire here might have been, it was more like a circumstance.
A little convenient.
Yeah, it was a little too convenient. You know, they just happen to be there.
It happens to be fall. It's really dry out there.
Yeah, and the farmers happen to do control burns once in a while to keep accidental fires from starting.
Everyone's going to be happy.
So, yeah, the military was like, we'll do the controlled burn for you this time. We might take out your house or something in the process, but, you know, don't worry about it.
Yeah.
They basically had the opportunity and they took it. You know, and the way it was written and everything, like, I did enjoy it. I really did enjoy it. It was cool to see some fire moths, too. I mean, they died before this battle, but see some fire moths doing their job. Some of the, you know, we had some actual ghost bear mechs in this book.
We did. But yeah, I mean, it is funny to look at it and think, okay,
it was a definite fan service book.
Yeah, is how much of it is just Pardo's writing style, and how much of, you know, is Out of the Wolf, how much of it does feel like it is lifted from Roar of Honor. I mean, many of the most important beats, how the characters feel, like it is, you know, you guys can't hear me bang on the table, like boom, 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 bullet points, like the characteristics of the protagonist and antagonist, how they get along with their own forces. You know, what's it like for them to do their thing? Everyone around them being relatively superfluous.
Yep.
You know, even the climactic battle is a giant fire.
The tanker crew doesn't really do much of anything. So, like, we have other characters that kind of bicker like they do.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
They don't really contribute to much.
Well, and that's the thing, too. Like, the Hour of the Wolf, you know, the tanker crew, I know, like, they managed to defeat some paladins and, you know, they're always in the right place at the right time. But in the grand scheme of things, you know, did they actually do all that much? And it doesn't really feel like that. Like, you know, they were there as
the relief, like the joking relief.
Comedic relief.
Yeah, comedic relief of the book.
Well, and that was the Pardo thing, too, is I remember it was after Hour of the Wolf came out, and then he posted on his blog the things he was trying to do, like with the tank crew, when one of the armor plates come off the tank. He's like, oh yeah, you know, the idea was, oh yeah, anything can happen. You know, these guys are in danger. But it didn't really mean anything. And it wasn't as though, oh shit, they're taking damage to that one spot where that armor plate came off of, or, you know, the tank treads got destroyed there or whatever. It didn't mean anything. And it's sort of the same thing with here. Stuff happens, it's alluded to, things are implied of being at risk, and nothing ever really happens. The shoe doesn't drop.
Yeah, it's like not everything has to have a freaking purpose. Or, like, not everything has to be, like, completely established, because sometimes you want that curveball, you know? But you just, there's no flow or, like, vibe to that in this book at all.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's, like we've been saying, it's very cut and dry.
Yeah, and
not dry as in, like, we're just sitting here dreading the whole time. I mean, I wasn't dreading the whole time.
No. I mean, it moved pretty fast. I mean, I really got tired. I really had to force my way through Hour of the Wolf to finish that.
So did I.
But this one, you know, for its faults, it's a fast read. I mean, it's like, boom, you know, you're through and you're done, you know.
Yeah. So, yeah, pretty much, like, if I had to rate this book, I mean, let's say, like, out of 5, I'd probably give it, like, a 3.5 or, like, 4.
Okay.
You know? And this is coming from my perspective of rereading it, you know, as an adult now. It hit the, like, because the thing is, like, my favorite BattleTech writer is Michael Stackpole.
Okay, yeah.
Because his novels read like an action movie, you know, like, and I like that. Because when I look at BattleTech books, like, I don't want, like, the Michael Bay, like tropes and shit, like, in the books, which pretty much, like, War of Honor does a lot. Like, it's pretty guilty of that.
Yeah.
You know, so did Hour of the Wolf. Like, it was very guilty of feeling like a Michael Bay movie.
Yeah.
You know? But, like, yeah, like, this book, it was definitely, because it was more constrained, it was, like, I kind of imagined this book feeling like the manly handshake in Predator, you know? Like, like when, you know what I mean? Like, you son of a bitch, like that kind of movie, you know? Yeah. And it felt good for what it was trying to accomplish. Was it great? Eh. But, you know, it was like one of those action movies you watch just because it's fun.
Yeah. I can see that. I mean, for me...
Plus, I'm a Ghost Bear fan.
You're a Ghost Bear fan, yeah. For me, I give it, you know, like a 2.5, you know, or like a 2. I mean, not, it's not a failing book. You know, it, like I said, on a grading scale, it'd be a C minus, right? Mm-hmm. It set out to do what it was supposed to do. It moved at a good pace. Some stuff was okay. Some stuff was pretty dumb. You do see Pardo's bad habits in here. And I do wonder the other novels that he's written. I have not read his Northwind Highlander stuff. I would be curious what those are like. And if the things that he does show up there too. Mm-hmm. The stuff that I see here that showed up in Hour of the Wolf, is that going to be there in those other books?
Yeah. When we write about the fire in Hour, this is exactly why I wanted to go back and read this, because I wanted you to experience it and see if you came to the same conclusion I did, because that was one of the first things I noticed.
Yeah.
And that's where, like, I started going back through, like, you know, as we said in here, like, a lot of the characters, they do seem like they were, I don't necessarily think, like, plucked from it. He might have done that as kind of a nod to Roar of Honor, because maybe he enjoyed writing this book, for all you know. You know what I mean? Like, maybe it was one that was really fun for him. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. I mean, assuming it was. I get the impression that, well,
he is a fan.
He is a fan. I get the impression that when he was writing for BattleTech, he was enjoying what he was doing, except for when he was kind of planning his exit in general, his pivot to other stuff.
And we'll never know why, which is fine.
Yeah, yeah. There are people that I've seen on Facebook who have known Blaine, like, in person or from other gaming groups, who have said that his exit from the franchise was probably coming anyway because he was seeing some other opportunities for him.
Yeah.
And he probably wanted to write other stuff. I mean, I know he wrote his Blue Dawn novel, which I have absolutely no interest in reading.
No.
It's tough. I mean, is it a matter of, you know, the grass is always greener? But I do get the feeling that when he was writing for BattleTech, up to and including Hour of the Wolf, I feel he was doing it because he was enjoying it. I do feel that, especially with Hour of the Wolf, his worst habits were magnified by the length of the novel.
Yeah.
And he was maybe having a little bit too much fun with himself.
Yeah. Now, do you think, because this was something we talked about off recording for a little bit, as far as, like, the editing for the books. Now, because you think, like, this book is published under Rock, and they use their own editors.
Yeah.
Do you think that because our Aurora of Honor had, like, in-house editors that essentially, like, that's all they do?
Yeah.
Like, do you think, like, that sort of helped Blaine out a lot more? Because I know a lot of the stuff now is, and I'm not saying, like, it's terrible because they're using in-house editors, you know? Because, like,
So with
they're
Rock,
all passionate about the game, too.
Yeah, yeah. With Rock, I mean, obviously, you know, they've got someone full-time. You know, Rock, I don't even know if Rock is still around, and they've probably been bought by somebody else by now, but, you know, they were, you know, a big publishing company. They got people on payroll reading books and doing editing.
Yeah, like, that is their thing.
You know, I know with Catalyst, you know, a lot of it was, they only had, you know, you could count them on one hand, people who are full-time employees, until recently. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, we'll see what ends up happening with them, you know, as, like, the Kickstarters continue, as they begin to diversify and hopefully are able to release more consistent content to continue funding things. You know, at the time, you know, using a lot of people who were working part-time or freelance and doing another full-time job and then writing their own stuff for BattleTech and then doing editing for BattleTech. I mean, Hour of the Wolf and a lot of the Pardo series of stuff, I mean, has really suffered. I mean, they're full of typos. They're just a fucking hot mess.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you have Pardo's problems of not being able to keep things straight. And then how many things are going to get caught by the editor if it's a whole wall on the page of just mess-ups?
Mm-hmm.
I do think having someone who is professional, who's going to go through, and who's also somebody who's not your friend, you know, they're there to do a job to make sure that this looks good.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, it's a different story.
Yeah. And, you know, this goes back to your experience you had at ReaperCon. You know, like, those people, like, I mean, they're, like, friends now. I mean, or acquaintances. But, like, they're looking at your stuff you know, like as not like a fan or nothing, like this is a third party.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like they're going to look at you from a different perspective.
Yeah, yeah. They're going to tell you what they like.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to tell you what they think is really cool and what you did well. And they're going to tell you, like, this is what you need to do to improve.
Yeah. Not every Dan out there has a friend like Adam that's going to tell him his painting sucks. So he gets better, you know?
It's a hard job, but it's
someone's got to do it.
Someone's got to do it.
Somebody's got to do it.
And I tell Dan he sucks and I do it for free.
A lot of people do that for free.
But yeah, no, I do think the quality of what was published for BattleTech was better when they had professional editors that was their job. Not every BattleTech novel that has come out has the quality been as rough as Pardo's stuff was. And that's even including like the short story that he did for the last proliferation cycle short. You know, Pardo's stuff has been rough. And there are things that you can catch elsewhere in other books, but usually they're pretty good. And maybe you get like a typo, a chapter or something. You can talk about, you know, maybe issues with pacing or editing that could be more subjective. But with Pardo's stuff, I mean, with Hour of the Wolf and other things, I mean, it was a hot fucking mess. And with the Rock book, it wasn't like that.
Yeah. Out of curiosity, do you remember off the top of your head how many times Hour was reprinted, so to say, or like
good
edited?
Good question. Let me look that up.
Yeah.
Because I know, I mean, it was a couple. Yeah, I remember when it first came out, you know, there were missing chapters. Because at the end of almost every section, there was a chapter by one, you know, Innersphere intelligence agency that, you know, talking about what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I mean, it some of those were just, they just weren't there. So, yeah, I don't know how many different printings there are. I kind of want to be careful with what I download because yeah. When I read it, I do really want to read what I read the first time with all the missing stuff and all the mistakes, like the Black Knight with the autocannon, just like shit that doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's there. But yeah, I know there's got to be at least 3 or 4 revisions, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, oddly enough, the BattleTech novel that I really, really enjoyed from that same kind of cluster of books that came out, which I don't know if it got a lot of attention or not, but I thought was really, really awesome, and I'm looking it up right now. It's the one you guys should all read if you get the chance. Here it is. Icons of War by Craig Reed. That one's really good, and that's about the Clan Wolf plan to steal back McKenna's pride.
It was
Vlad Ward's idea, and he left a couple of Clan Wolf warriors behind to make it happen. And it's really, really cool. And even the very end of the book is really, really cool. And it's just a shame that sort of quality didn't continue through to what was supposed to be the capstone novel of 35 years of BattleTech.
Yeah, you got to understand, you know, we came into a time where we had Exodus Road, you know, we had that novel, we had Wolves on the Border, you know, all these different good novels, and then we're supposed to get the climatic end, essentially, with Hour of the Wolf, and we didn't get that.
Well, and that's the thing, is, you know, how much of
Roar of Honor gave us a better ending.
Yeah, how much of you know, Pardo's problems just were tempered by people at Rock. I mean, Hour of the Wolf seemed to come out at a time when just everything I was waiting for just fucking dropped the ball. I mean, whether it was...
It did, yeah, it came out at a really,
you know,
bad time.
Rise of Skywalker, Game of Thrones Season 8.
Yeah.
The last Tool album, I mean, just everything hurt.
And then Hour of the Wolf comes out. I know
that Tool album really got you.
Yeah, and then the Hour of the Wolf comes out, and like, man, everything fucking sucks.
Yeah, I mean,
even and I was just like, and I was really nostalgic because, you know, what came out, you know, 20 years ago? You know, what finished up 20 years ago? Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings trilogy, which is fucking perfect from beginning to end.
We were spoiled. We were really spoiled. You know,
I mean, granted, The Hobbit was bad, but that's for a whole bunch of different reasons. But, man, Fellowship, Two Towers, Return of the King, man, back to back, year after year.
And we didn't expect that with Hour, but, I mean, yeah. We're talking about the end of a story, essentially. Yeah. Like, they would have had their clean slate to start over.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. And, that, you know... Yeah, blew it. Yeah.
So yeah, there we have it. That is a very, very long.
Very long and justified. I did like Hour of the Wolf. Or not Hour of the Wolf.
Oof, Dan.
Uh-oh. What are you doing here? Roar of Honor. I'm gonna keep that clip of I liked Hour of the Wolf. I'm gonna start the Hour of the Wolf episode with that, and then we're gonna have it slowly degrade into me like getting like drunker and drunker as we're talking about it. You regret saying that now, don't you? Yeah.
But yeah, that was our take on Roar of Honor. It was actually our second take, because the first time we did it was like, yeah, we can do better.
Yeah, it was a bad day.
But yeah, so that's that, guys. You know, we're glad to be back. You know, I don't know. We're not doing this job for a living. Like, we're not monetizing this shit. I mean, what we made? How many cents do we make on our biggest video? Like,
we didn't make anything because we can't make anything yet.
Yeah. So. Whatever. You know, this is just kind of as we come up with ideas what we want to talk about and do. And so, yeah, I mean, let us know what you think. Are we off base here with our criticisms? Are we on point with our commendations? Does Blaine Pardot want to complain about us complaining about him?
Yeah. Or what Blaine books do you actually like?
Yeah, I mean, there are things I can look at, and I think, you know, I really dug that. You know, I really dug this.
Betrayal of Ideals, liked.
There are things that Blaine's done that I really do like. But I, as I've become more cognizant and read more of his stuff, I'm beginning to see where his bad habits are. And you know, I love Stackpole. Stackpole's got his problems, too. You know,
they all do. I mean, everyone's going to have their problems.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but in Hour, it was very apparent. And in Roar of Honor... it's definitely not there as much.
Yeah, yeah.
It is a better read. I would recommend a BattleTech fan read this book, honestly.
Well, if you want to be a clan, if you're a clan fan, you know, it's this one, and then there was another one that I think that Randall Bills wrote that was pretty good that I read. There was like a Draconis Combine warrior and a Novacat warrior.
Yeah.
That one was pretty good. I don't have that off the top of my head, but I have it on my bookshelf.
Betrayal of Ideals is another good one too. I did enjoy that.
Well, and Betrayal of Ideals was sort of like, you know, finally the truth is revealed, to a degree. You know,
to a degree.
But yeah, and then that was long, guys. If you stuck around, thanks for sticking around. If you're finding us for the first time, cool. You can subscribe if you want. You can like it if you want. I don't really fucking care.
do what you got to do, man.
But I mean, yeah, I'd be curious to see, you know, if you guys have listened to the end, you know, what you guys thought about Roar of Honor or any other novels that you like. We've got a couple of other ideas of what we'd like to read and discuss about. I don't know if we're going to be doing videos too much anymore because it feels like a lot more work. And I kind of like just sitting down and just chatting.
Yeah, I like that too.
Plus,
I
mean, the camera's all shut off after 30 minutes anyway.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, if we did any videos, we'd probably do like a parody or something.
Yeah, like a tutorial or something short. Mm-hmm. But yeah, guys, thanks for stopping by. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks for getting us above 600 subscribers too. We never thought we would have gotten that far, honestly. I mean, that's pretty cool, honestly.
Yeah, it is. It is. I mean, hopefully we'll keep growing. But yeah. Well, awesome. I'm Adam.
I'm Dan.
And we will catch you next time.
Will we? I'll catch you if you fall. All right, bye, guys.
As he says that with his bad back.